everybody. I'm Bob Claster.
And I'm Tom Strother.
And our guest in the studio is one of the more clever ape-descended life forms of this or any other planet. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has been a radio program, a series of novels, a series of records, a television series, a stage play, and rumor has it that a feature film is to follow. For those who have been unlucky enough to have missed it in all of its incarnations, The Hitchhiker's Guide is a comedy which begins with the destruction of the planet Earth and ends with our not finding out God's last message to his creation, and along the way takes the opportunity to comment about everything from the existence of God to the absurdity of digital watches, and all in a delightfully entertaining manner. The author of all of the above is Douglas Adams. Tell me, Douglas, can Hitchhiker's Guide cocktail napkins be far behind?
No, well, there are finally going to be one or two bits of sort of merchandising coming down the line, which there haven't been all this time.
Well, if you have a film, that's inevitable.
Yeah, I guess so.
Will there be digital watches?
There is actually now going to be a calendar and a diary coming up, which I've... I think the calendar is actually going to be quite fun because we're getting... a lot of artists together to do scenes from it, and though we've only just been talking about it this last week, so we don't know actually who's going to be involved. Though we certainly know who we're asking. And one of my favourite ideas is actually to sort of get the various artists to go, you know, against their natural patterns. So, for instance, get one of the sort of classic heroic science fiction type artists to do the picture of Arthur Dent lying in front of the bulldozer, but do that in a sort of dramatic style. I think that would be quite funny. And also, it's actually probably going to be an expurgated calendar because. I mean, I have a particular thing about Thursdays. I don't like Thursdays, so we think we may leave them out.
Neither does Arthur Dent.
Other than that, well, I'm actually, this is probably premature actually to say this, but I'll say it anyway, because there are all sorts of things about the deal which still have to be sorted out, but I think I'm doing a computer adventure game for Infocom, you know, who made Zork and so on.
What fun.
Which should be fun. You know, I mean, the merchandising side of things is something I've never really sort of actively pursued much myself because I don't think, you know, I'm a writer, not a businessman, so to speak. And so...
Has all this mushroomed far beyond your initial expectations?
Well, put it this way. If I'd expected all this from sitting down to write that radio series, then there would have been good cause to lock me up, I think.
Why did you start to write the radio series? How did that actually
poverty
get... Poverty and despair. You talked somebody into an idea for it? Or?
Yeah, more or less. I've been trying to sell the idea of doing comedy science fiction for ages to all sorts of people and all sorts of media. Nobody was really interested until finally one man, scholar and gentleman Simon Brett. He sort of took the thing under his wing and championed it. Only actually stayed on to do the first episode before he then went on to another job in TV.
There are all sorts of stories about the production of that thing over there. I've heard one of the other producers for BBC, not someone who did the show. I can't recall his name.
A producer at radio.
At radio, yeah. He was just up the hall from where your people were. Was talking about people running down the halls with scripts at the very last minute.
This is most certainly true. Yes, towards the end. I mean, I was in one room writing it, and the actors are in the next room performing it.
This was for the first six episodes.
No, this was towards the end of the last episodes. The thing was, I had actually taken on too much work. This is the problem, because I wasn't prepared for how successful it was going to be and what the demands were going to be on my time. And also because it had taken me so long to write it in the first place, and the financial rewards for writing radio are minimal, to say the least. And, it just simply wasn't possible to keep body and soul alive, you know, working in that way. And I had to have some support from my parents at that point, so I thought it's unfair to do that, and I'd taken on a job a full-time job with the BBC as well as producer and then script editor of Doctor Who. And, of course, did that at precisely the wrong time because I had no idea that Hitchhiker was going to become so big. So anyway, I was actually overcommitted at that point, and we did get to the stage towards the end of the series when, as I say, I was writing the thing in one room and the actors were performing it as it came out of my typewriter.
And then they re-recorded it, right?
We re-recorded the first episodes for record. We did three LPs worth altogether, a double and a single.
And was there also a 45?
Oh, well, there was...
I've heard about it. It's entitled Marvin the Paranoid Android.
That's right, yes, which was put together by Stephen Moore, who plays the voice of Marvin, and is also one of our sort of... major theatre actors in England.
That's a sought after collector's piece. Is it?
Well, it wasn't being sought after much in the shops, I must say. I mean, it went out and it got a few airplays, and people said,
"Is it
yes.
a song?"
Yes, of a kind.
I wish we had it.
Disco record.
If anybody out there has that record, please send it to us, and we'll make a copy of it because we can't buy them anymore.
Right.
You did the six episodes. You came back and did another six episodes or another seven episodes?
Well,
we've heard rumors that there
were
13
in it. It was a little complicated. No, it was 12 altogether because there were six, then a single episode, then five episodes.
Is there any difference between the episodes as aired in Britain and as aired here? That's something I've heard. That
you may have slightly edited ones. I don't know, because a lot of the ones in England actually overspilled their time. I mean, they would have been, some of them, up to about sort of 33, 34 minutes long.
You had some clever editors, because as you listen to the records and you listen to the tapes, you know there are things that are on the tapes that aren't on the records, but it's very difficult to figure out what you're missing.
The guys, actually, the editors in BBC Radio are incredible technicians. I mean, the way they work is just phenomenal. I mean, the accuracy and speed and the is really quite something, and it's a level of editing skill which I think you probably don't get in TV, and it's partly because yes, when you're editing in radio, well, I mean, you know, I mean, you will know this, but they won't know it out there. When you're editing in radio, you actually have the physical tape in your hands, and you know that, whereas people say a second, meaning, you know, an almost negligibly short period of time. A second is a good 15 inches of tape, or 30 inches, or whatever speed you're recording at, but say 15 inches of tape. And there's a lot you can do with 15 inches of tape. Mm-hmm. And when you come down to fine editing on a comedy show to get the pacing right and get the moves between scenes right and getting rid of lines that don't work, or correcting somebody's pronunciation and all that kind of thing, you know, the actual physical presence of the tape actually makes a difference. Now, on TV editing, for instance, because it's all done, because you have, in one sense, a great deal more control over it, because it's all done by computer and you can do it to the frame, because the physical thing isn't there, I think the editing on TV is actually a lot sloppier, and because people aren't aware of how long a second is.
Well, that brings up a question. Were you happy with the television version of the
Hitchhiker's Guide? Not entirely. Now, I'll tell you, what I did like about the TV version were the graphics, which I thought were excellent.
It was fantastic.
The interesting thing about that is they were presented as computer graphics. The tiny little animation company, who were really great, who did them by hand because they didn't have a computer. And you know, so they're just hand animations, and the way that animation has always been done. But you see, a lot of the rest of it. I have to say that the director actually used to say himself, well, he didn't understand what it was all about, and I felt that wasn't actually a good enough attitude to go into it with. And there was quite a lot of personality conflict actually between myself and the director, and between the cast and the director, and between the production crew and the director. And I mean, you see, I should be careful what I say, but
that's a pity.
I just felt it was. I felt the cast was underdirected because I mean they're all very good, And obviously a lot of them were people already... Sorry?
Were you happy with the casting?
Well, obviously Simon Jones, Mark Queen Davey, Stephen Moore doing the voice of Marvin, all that. You know, it was exactly what I wanted.
One of them comes to mind, and that's Trillian. Trillian was a very different character.
Yeah. Now, there's something interesting there, because I think we did one thing right and one thing wrong. The one thing right we did was actually casting Sandra. And I'll tell you for why. When we were... when we were auditioning the part, and actually somebody suggested Sandra, and you know, knowing what her sort of persona was, I said, "Oh, come on, that's a ridiculous idea. I mean, that'd be awful." But I said, "No, no, no. I mean, just you know, humour me. Let's have her in." So I said, "Okay, well, you know, all right, have her in." And we had seen, you know, something like a dozen or 20 actresses who'd come in and read the part. All of them, you know, doing something or other right, or something or other wrong, but none of them sort of making us feel, yeah, that's it. And Sandra came in, and she instantly read the part, just in terms of the way she read the lines, much, much more intelligently, with much greater sense of what they meant than anybody else did. And it was quite clear she had to have the part. But... where we made the mistake was this. She then said, "Well, look, this is her natural speaking voice, the voice you heard, that sort of strange sort of New York baby doll accent, is actually her natural speaking voice. That's how she was brought up to speak." So she said, "I mean, she's actually a very, very versatile actress." And she said, "I can do, you know, whatever voice you like. I can do you an English Rose if you like." And she gave us a demonstration, and it was actually an incredibly good one. But we said, "No, I mean, you got the part fair and square the way you read it, so we wouldn't want to impose another burden on you." And that was actually a slightly silly thing to say, you know, because she's an actress. She could do it. I mean, she was offering us all kinds of different ways of doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I think the right thing was in casting her, and the wrong thing was not getting her to change her accent.
Did the characters change from their initial inspirations due to the interpretations of the actors? I mean, I suppose when you first wrote them, you had no actors in mind, and then after...
Oh, no, quite the opposite, actually. When I started writing it, I very definitely had Simon and Jones in mind to play Arthur, and Jeff McGiven to play Ford, though he wasn't available when we came to... do the TV show. Or rather, I mean, what had actually happened was that the casting on the TV show hadn't been done and was still some way down the road. And Jeffrey simply had to make up his mind, as actors frequently do have to, between a part he was being definitely offered then and the possibility that he would or wouldn't be offered the part of Ford on TV. Decided to go for the bird in the hand rather than two in the bush, I was very sorry not to have Jeffrey there for that. On a more somber note, one of the things that deeply concerns me and a number of people at the moment is that Jeff McGiven has actually disappeared. No one knows where he has been for the last 18 months. He did go through a bad stage at one point when he actually underwent a nervous breakdown and had to be hospitalised, and then came out and then suddenly disappeared. No one knows where on earth he is. Anyway, that's Jeffrey McGiven, who plays Ford Prefect in the radio series. No one knows where in the world he is or how he is or what's happened to him. Mm. I don't suppose for a moment he's over here, but if anybody does have any news where...
If you're out there in the audience.
If anybody knows where Jeffrey McGiven is, then there are a lot of people, myself especially included, who would very much like to know.
But the characters did seem to evolve as they went along. And where did that come from? How did that happen?
Oh, yes. I mean, sorry. The question
seemed to get more obnoxious, for instance, as it went along. And I wondered if that was due to the interpretation of the actor imposed upon your original conception.
Well, they sort of went hand in hand to a certain extent, because writing and recording to a certain extent overlapped, even right at the beginning. Then a lot of what the actors were feeding back in performance. I was then reflecting or writing to when I was writing the characters. Yeah, because obviously you start off with the tone of voice in your mind. Then the actor brings to it his own tone of voice, and then you start to hear that tone of voice and mm-hmm. you get back to mm-hmm. writing. So, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship almost between the writer and the actor.
John Le Carré has said that he may not ever be able to write another Smiley book because of Guinness's performance.
Well, it's the same thing.
He took over the character, and now every time he thinks of of Smiley, he thinks of Guinness, and that's...
Right. Yes, I mean, there's an interesting thing there, you see.
It's like John Mortimer and Leo McKern with Rumpel. It's the same sort of thing.
And, I mean, that is an absolutely natural part of the way that... any performance medium works. Now, in the case of Alec Guinness playing George Smiley, he was not the picture, I'm sure. Well, obviously, he was not the picture, and John Le Carré has said that he had in mind for Smiley, and he's not really the picture that the audience would have in mind. But, on the other hand, what Guinness brought to it, brought the character to such a pitch of life, albeit slightly differently, but it was Guinness doing what he could with the character. Given the fact it wasn't really sort of naturally his character, yes, it went through a sea change. But that's neither a criticism of him mm-hmm. nor a criticism of the original. It's just something quite natural to the process of turning something into a performance.
Tell me, apart from the fact that, I mean, obviously The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has been good for you and has made your reputation and hopefully has been lucrative as well, are you sick of it?
I periodically get sick of it. And then, I mean, I'm actually about to sit down and write another book, which for once I'm actually looking forward to, because for a long time, there was a long period when I was absolutely sick of it. But, you know, had commitments, writing commitments on it to fulfill, which I really had to steel myself for.
That's for the third book?
Yes. I mean, there were all sorts of other things going on in my life at that stage.
I suppose we should mention by name since it's currently
on paperback.
Life,
the universe and everything. I found that very, very hard to write because there was a whole lot of other stuff going on in my life at the time which I was finding it hard to cope with. And I was on the one hand, I was actually terribly unhappy about a lot of stuff and then was trying to write a comic book. And the two activities, you know, don't naturally go together. But since then, I got a lot of stuff sorted out, and I've actually managed to get some of the pressure off me because a lot, you know, when you suddenly have that amount of success, you're not actually prepared for it. You don't know how to cope with it. You don't know what to steel yourself for, what to prepare yourself for, what to lay aside, what to do, what not to do. And I think, you know, in the last year, I've probably got a firmer and clearer perspective on it now. And suddenly, you know, I feel that with a new, sort of slightly more balanced perspective on it, that I'm actually looking forward to getting back in there again.
What will you be getting back in there again to do?
Well,
is there a fourth book? Are there more radio series?
A fourth book, which will have a relatively simple theme this time, because I thought the last one got much too complicated.
It does tend to lose you here and there.
It was probably overly complicated. I mean, this, and the reason for that, I think, is because it was one that I'd plotted in advance, which for some reason doesn't seem quite to work with Hitchhiker, because then whenever I've got a particular plot point, I then build so many other things on and around it that if the point was complicated to begin with, then all the other complications on top of it make it overcomplicated. This time I've actually got a very simple quest theme through this,
the best
which
things.
I think will give me a better chance of making it a slightly less convoluted book than the last one. I mean, the last book, I mean, Life, the Universe and Everything, has got some of my favourite bits of the three of them in it, but I just think the shape is...
What are some of your favorite bits of the whole thing so far? I mean, of the story so far.
Well, I'll tell you, in Life, the Universe and Everything, I finally did something which I'd wanted to do for years and years and years in writing, which was to realize the flying dream. Now, I have, and I'm sure most people have, the flying dream, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. which... in the dream, you suddenly know how to fly. And it's actually, it's laughably simple. And it's really, it's an attitude of mind. It's almost a sort of Zen thing, I'm sure. And it's, you know, the feeling of doing it comes so naturally that when you wake up in the morning and you feel your sort of the weight of yourself lying there in the bed and it slowly dawns on you that you can't do it, it's the most crushing disappointment. And so I've always wanted to do a description of somebody actually learning to fly and doing it in the way that one imagines it in the dream. And I'd had that sort of planned for a long, long time. And I was looking for the right way to say it. I eventually found, you know, just one phrase that expressed the sort of kernel of what I meant.
I remember it.
Which was that the knack of flying is in learning how to throw yourself at the ground and miss.
Yes.
So I did the short passage on describing the technique of flying and leave it aside. And then later create the right circumstances for it suddenly to happen to Arthur, and he suddenly finds himself flying. Now, normally, I find that writing is very sort of tedious and tortuous, and I have to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and drive myself crazy with rewriting. I mean, for instance, I mean, the first line of the first 20 pages of the draft of this book, I rewrote actually 20 times, at the end of which they resulted in the first line. I mean, the first line of the book started as 20 pages, which 20 rewrites later was just one line. But the chapter in which Arthur actually flies, because as I said, I had it at the back of my mind for so long and I knew what it felt like, is the only time I've ever just written a chapter, just like that. And don't think I changed a word. In fact, going back, the words, now I would have liked to have changed, but I felt so pleased with the thought that I'd written a whole chapter without changing a word that I wanted to leave it sort of intact, and I probably could have improved a couple of bits, but I liked the idea of it being a first shot. So that's something I was very pleased with.
Will any of this turn up as radio?
There are no plans for that at the moment, but I don't... I've given up making long-term predictions.
Mm-hmm. Who would predict the cocktail?
Back to what you were saying, it seems as though perhaps another one of those ideas, I don't know, maybe I'm absolutely wrong, was somebody else's problem.
Mm. Yeah. Yes.
The somebody else's problem field.
I think that's wonderful. there's an edge of real wisdom and truth in all of these little gems that flow throughout this thing. That make it is more compelling, more interesting, and funnier, really.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's often the problems of something which of dealing with an idea which produce the best whole ideas. I mean, for instance, going back to the first book, and where the infinite improbability drive came from. That was because I'd written myself into a corner. I'd got Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent hurled out of this spaceship. I'd read somewhere, I can't remember where it was, that if you hyperventilate and then expel all the air from your lungs just before you go out into space, you could possibly survive 30 seconds. So I thought, okay, well, I can give them 30 seconds out there. But what do I do? And every idea I'd come up with about how they got rescued was just a sort of ludicrous, with one bound Jack is free, improbable sort of solution. And because I didn't regard myself as being in business to send up the conventions of science fiction, which is easy peasy. I mean, that's, you know, it's shooting apples in a barrel. So I didn't want to just do that. And I was wrestling with the problem of what would be an apt way of rescuing them and dealing with that. And it was the improbability of the thing, which was bogging me down the whole time. And I then happened to see this show on TV, which is talking about judo and techniques of judo. And somebody explained the technique of judo. He said that the point of judo is that you use the weight of your opponent against himself. Use his strength and power and weight against himself. Don't try and match it. Just go with it let him trip himself. So I thought something's trying to say something to me here. So I went back to the improbability I was wrestling with and then thought, okay, they get rescued by an improbability force, the improbability drive. And then that, then explaining why that would be then leads on to a whole new area. And you feel then you've actually balanced the problem with the solution. I mean, another example is... oh, yes, I mean, this is a very clear one. It's so irritating when you see a Star Trek or whatever, or Doctor Who, which I worked on, or any of these, that wherever you go, I mean, this is an oldest cliche in the book, everyone in the universe speaks English. And no one has ever offered any explanation for that. But if you're going to... But I wanted the world I was creating out there to be real in some way. Or as real as I could make it within the constraints imposed by a number of fantastical things I was doing anyway. So I wanted to find an explanation for that, and eventually came up with the idea of the Babelfish. But in order to explain that, you then have to offer all sorts of side explanations, and that's actually where it begins to get interesting. Actually, all explaining all the problems you encounter.
And that's where the guide comes in.
That's where the guide comes in. That's where somebody else's problem came from.
It's a wonderful
because
convention.
It had to be, the spaceship had to be there. But then, if it was going to be there, then people would see it was there, in which case that scene wouldn't run properly because it would be just involved, what's that spaceship doing there? And I wanted the spaceship to be there as far as we were concerned and not there as far as anybody else is concerned. Mm-hmm. And it's not enough just to say, oh, well, it's invisible. How is it invisible? Why would it be invisible? Because when you see in a Superman comic or something, something becomes invisible. There's no physical... there's nothing within any comprehension of physics which makes that possible. It's only magic. And magic in itself isn't interesting.
Doesn't work in science fiction.
So, right. So there has to be some sort of rational explanation, or if it doesn't admit of rational explanation, then there must be some irrational explanation. And to find a good irrational explanation, you have to go to an irrational center, i.e. human beings. Now, why would human beings, they're your only fund of irrationality. Therefore, there has to be something in a human being which would prevent them seeing the object, not something in the object which prevents it being seen. So that's where the idea of the somebody else's problem field came from.
So what's next?
Fantastic.
Well,
either Hitchhikers or non-Hitchhiker projects.
Well, there are two things. One, which is absolutely imminent, and that I have a book co-authored with a friend of mine called John Lloyd, who was the creator and co-producer and co-writer of a very successful English TV show called Not the 9 O'Clock News, which I don't think really happened over here.
It's been adapted into a program called Not Necessarily
right,
the News.
Right, yeah. And anyway, he and I have written a book called The Meaning of Lif, which is coming out in England in a couple of weeks' time, and will be out in America in the spring.
It's spelled L-I-F?
L-I-F-F. It's a town somewhere in the British Isles.
Probably Wales.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about that book in a moment. And the other thing is one more Hitchhiker book, which will be... now, you mentioned when you were in your introduction that the third book ends with the unresolved question of what God's final message to his creation is. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the search for that, which is the thrust of the last book. And one area in which well, if I was being ruthlessly honest, I would say failed. And if I was trying to doll it up, I'd say had been ambivalent in the past, is that there have been a number of questions I've raised and then not properly resolved or left sort of dangling in a sort of, a tantalizing kind of way. I mean, for instance, what is the question to which the answer is 42? Mm-hmm. And that, I can never actually come up. I mean, people keep on asking me what it is, and I can never... Obviously, you can never come up with something that is going to fit, because the moment you come up with anything, it's actually going to reduce the whole concept of that idea. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I do know what God's final message to his creation is. Well, at least within the universe I'm creating here. And so I thought that just for once, I would actually stop teasing people and would actually bring it out. So, so that'll be what the fourth book is. It'll be Arthur, who we've left living a sort of idyllic but slightly bored life on the planet of cricket. And he eventually decides to get moving again because he's bored. And because this thing has been nagging away at the back of his mind, he decides to go and find it.
Is he going to get to some place where he can get a change of clothes? I'm really curious about it.
Or at least one of the dry cleaners.
This is one of the things that the television series did for me, which I had just not thought about. I mean, he's wandering around in his bath. Same for you? Really?
Yeah, I hadn't thought. I just hadn't thought about it. And it was only, you know, when we came to do the TV series that we thought, what is he wearing? And I suddenly realized that he must still be wearing his dressing gown. And it never occurred to me, I think, writing the first and the second book, that he was wearing his dressing gown.
It was very helpful to his character throughout to see him wandering around in this hopeless bathrobe.
But the third book, which was written subsequent to the TV series, is the first one in which I then actually start mentioning the dressing gown again.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting, actually, for someone to come along and read the three books without any knowledge of the other part and see where the sort of inconsistencies and discrepancies creep in, which are actually accounted for by what was going on in the radio or TV version.
What sort of stage play was it?
Well, it was several different kinds of stage plays, of which two were done by Ken Campbell. Do you know who I mean by Ken Campbell? Is it a name that means anything over here? He was very much a sort of wild man, enfant terrible, of English fringe theatre. I mean, he was a sort of wonderful sort of crazy. Well, I say was. I mean, it's just because I haven't heard what he's been up to recently. But he would do all sorts of really crazy projects. He put on one. He put on the play of Illuminatus at 11 hours in length, and then put on another play which is 24 hours long.
And in one usually, sitting? I mean, this is
not
like Nicholas
and he would
Nickleby
do all kinds of weird things, usually with just whatever actors would sort of next walk into the room. He'd say, all right, I'll have you. You know, you can do this part. And anyway, so he did a version of Hitchhiker. He did the very first stage version of Hitchhiker, which was a bit, to my mind, was a little bit too much sort of comic book. And it was very truncated. But it worked in its own terms. It actually worked very well. And I mean, it wasn't what I had in mind when I wrote it. But, you know, you have to let people, you know, find their own interpretation. And it worked. What was interesting about it was that it was done in a relatively small little theatre, which we only have for 2 weeks. And it was advertised that the audience would be floating on a hovercraft and would be taken around the production on a hovercraft. Now, Ken Campbell has a certain reputation, you know, for being, you know, eccentric and crazy and saying whatever came into his mind. So, so everyone assumed...
You don't have truth in advertising problems there, do you?
Yeah. Well, he assumed, you know, that it was
Trade Description Act, is that what they call it?
Yeah, I mean, everyone assumed this was creative advertising. I mean, you know what I mean, creative advertising, like Eastern Airlines, America's favorite way to fly. I mean, that is creative advertising. It in no way reflects anything to do with the truth whatsoever. And so everyone's saying, you know, it was a lie. And so what was astonishing was that the early scene with the bulldozer and stuff was actually done by puppets out in the foyer. And then you were taken through into the thing, and you got on the strange platform, this sort of this huge sort of exploding light show and sound going on around you to signify the Earth being destroyed. And then when everybody's on the platform, it took off. It actually took off, only by an eighth of an inch, But it was floating, and it floated around the theatre. And all the actors were sort of hanging onto walls, you know, to do their next scene. And this audience would bear down across the theatre with them. It was very, very strange production.
That's delightful.
And then, but
this only ran for 2 weeks.
Yeah, it only ran for 2 weeks. But you see, we
sounds expensive,
Yeah, we could only get 80 people in, because that was as many as you could get on the hovercar. We were turning away 1,500 people a night. And we thought this has to be the wrong way around. And so Ken then later put on, about a year or so later, decided to put on a much bigger show. And this got completely out of hand, and it was crazy. And Ken actually lost his enthusiasm for it because it got so crazy. And the eventual show was a bit of a fiasco. And it was done in a huge 3,000-seater theatre. But without any real sort of controlling or guiding force. And it was a mess, and that didn't last. But in between times, an experimental theatre group based up in North Wales called Theatre Clwyd started mounting a production, which was actually a very, very faithful production. And being faithful meant, apart from the else, it was very long. And they toured Wales with it, and they toured England with it, and then they toured it again. And it regularly comes and goes, and other people are doing stage productions. And I believe there was a stage production, a very small scale one done at Berkeley over here, and I think there's one going on in Australia. And curiously enough, I mean, the best of them really do work in a strange kind of way. I mean, it requires. I mean, it's definitely a theatrical experience of a different type.
While we're covering media, is there any truth to the story of a failed American television production?
Oh, thank God there is. Yes, I mean, thank God for the word failed. The best thing actually, which came out of that, as far as I was concerned, was meeting this man who I subsequently got to know a great deal better, called Ron Cobb.
The artist, the cartoonist?
Yeah, that's right, the cartoonist and later film designer, who is a great man, actually. I very much hope that, again, I'm probably speaking out of turn here, but what the hell, it's 6:15. And I very much hope that, I mean, assuming the film actually moves into the real world, I mean, I hope that Ron will be involved with it.
But it didn't work, the television.
No. Oh, it would have been crazy. It was one of these things, actually, was a deal which was sort of set up really when I wasn't sort of paying attention properly. And there was quite a bit of that going on at one stage, because I was really...
There's a lot of that going around.
Things would get done which would seem like a good idea at the time, and I hadn't really thought about it. And then when I was presented with the actual reality of what was going to be happening with an American TV version, I mean, I was... When it eventually folded, I mean, I was running up the flags.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's very striking about this is that, and I probably won't be making any points with you about this, but the first two books, listening to the radio series and then reading it, it works better as radio. And to my way of looking at it, it works better as radio than it did on either television or in print, because so much of it was sound. I mean, there were so many sound gags in there that made the lines fit together. I'm reminded of a point at which Zaphod is listening to the only remaining whole spaceship in a junkyard full of spaceships.
Oh, right, yes.
And he takes some tubing. He wants to listen, so he takes some tubing. And you hear the little click of the tubing going up, and then another click.
Right.
And then you heard a third click and a fourth click, and it suddenly dawns on you that he's listening with both heads to this thing. But, I mean, you can't do that sort of stuff in a book, really.
Well, the stuff you can do on radio you can't do in a book, but by the same token, the stuff you can do in a book you can't do on radio.
The third is not a radio series, and it's designed as a book. Works well as a book.
Mm. I think at the end will probably, you know, at the end of my life, when I sort of look back on it, I shall probably, you know, think of the books uppermost in my mind. But I'm, you know, there's quite a close tie between the radio series and the books. But certainly my mind is sort of concentrated on books now, I think.
You were going to tell us about Lif.
Oh yes, the meaning of Lif. I don't know if I brought a. There's one copy of the meaning of Lif.
I want it in
this continent sure. at the moment, and I forgot. It's sitting in my hotel room. I forgot to bring it with me. It's. I don't want to build up your hopes too much because this is really very much a sideshow. This is a bit of this is a confection, but actually I think it's quite funny. It started as something. It's not even an original idea. It was something I was given to do as an exercise at school when I was 12. And then subsequently, myself and John Lloyd, who's my collaborator on it, and one or two other people were sitting in a Greek island for a while. This is actually whilst I was starting to write the first book of Hitchhiker. And I sort of got a little villa out on a Greek island, therefore, because I needed to pay for it, got a lot of other people in as well. So we were sitting in a Greek taverna one afternoon, and we were playing charades and drinking a lot of Retsina. And after we'd drunk a certain amount of Retsina, we decided we actually wanted to find another game which would involve less standing up. And so we came up with this game. Somebody would say the name of a town, and somebody else would say what it meant. You had to be there.
I can see it.
You not only had to be there, you had to be
have the
drunk.
Retina. Yeah.
Yes. But we started writing some of these things down, and gradually discovered what was not a novel discovery, but it was an entertaining discovery to find for oneself. There are all kinds of situations, feelings, experiences, little things, for which, quite arbitrarily, no words exist. And at the same time, there are an awful lot of beautiful, wonderful, extraordinary words which have no other function in life other than to sit on signposts pointing at places. We thought we'd sort of start bringing them together. And actually, a concept having a name is actually quite an important thing. And you suddenly realize that the English dictionary is actually quite an arbitrarily selective thing. I mean, you imagine, my image for this, apparent to you, imagine somebody saying, do you know those things? Have you ever seen these things? I always see sort of big red things in the street, and they sort of go around in herds, and if you get on one, you can go to Oxford Circus on it. Somebody else said, you see those too? I thought it was just me. But as soon as you have a name for it, bus, then it becomes a lot simpler. So we started. Let me give you a few examples. Ely, which is a cathedral town somewhere in East Anglia. An Ely is the first tiniest inkling you get that something somewhere has gone terribly wrong. Kettering. Kettering describes the marks you get on the underside of your thigh when you've been sitting sunbathing in a wickerwork chair.
Great.
Imagine
kettleness. Kettleness is the inability to go to the bathroom because you think somebody's watching. Shubriness is the vague, uncomfortable feeling you get from sitting on a seat which is warm from somebody else's bottom. Woking is standing in the kitchen wondering what you came in here for.
A word. What was that again?
Woking. W-O-K-I-N-G.
I'll have to remember.
Won't you be flattered
sketty.
When some of these actually enter the usage?
Yeah. Sketty. A sketty is an apparently self-propelled little dance which a glass of beer performs in its own puddle. Laconia. Laconia is a form of mental disorder brought on by being Dick Cavett.
That one doesn't sound like it's contagious.
Rabness, which is spelt with a W, W-R-A-B-N-E-S-S. Is the uncomfortable feeling you get from drying yourself off with a slightly damp towel.
Will this be illustrated as well?
It's got maps. And it's got a very, very silly index.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
And it's funny because the book...
Why must it come out so much later here than there?
Well, because when I first described it... Pan Books in England wanted it. Nobody over here was really interested. They said, well, let's have a look at it when it's done, sort of thing. Because it's what, you know, it's a peculiarly English sort of thing. I'm really sort of enjoying this, The Meaning of Life, actually, because the success of the Hitchhiker books has been such that it's always nerve-wracking that the next one won't be such a success,
mm-hmm.
Because it's got such a thing to live up to. I mean, because in England, each of the books entered the bestseller list at number one.
Yeah, I was there when the last one came out.
And that's...
But they were originally published paperback, right?
That's right,
They never came out hardback. No,
well, they came out in hardback sort of a few months later, just for library editions. So, you know, one day... And maybe it'll be the next one. You know, I won't have an immediate number one or something. And, you know, and that's... So there's nowhere to go but down in a kind of way. Except in America, where I haven't, you know, haven't had that... Where I'm still sort of building, which is nice. But
well, Restaurant at the End of the Universe was on the New York Times bestseller list for a while.
Yes, but there's still
I rooted for it.
There's still higher for it to go, kind of thing. But no, in England, as I say, there's only down to go.
Mm-hmm.
Or just staying up there. Now, The Meaning of Life being, as I say, completely a sideshow and just done for fun.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't work out, and if nobody buys it and nobody likes it, it's too bad. It's just done for fun. And if it does do well, then that's a tremendous extra bonus. But so one will enjoy every bit of how well it does without being disappointed by how well it doesn't do, if you see what I mean. So that... Sorry, that's obviously just very subjective to me talking as an author here, but I mean, that's...
Totally unrelated question. I was puzzled by the mention in the book notes as to your connection with Monty Python.
Yes, well, this is something which has been much exaggerated. And the reason for this is that I suppose when I was first introduced to America... and nobody knew anything about me at all, but somebody in a public relations department discovered that I had worked with Graham Chapman once of Python, they're not actually on Python, and therefore sort of promoted that relationship, and it just got it actually isn't true. I did work with Graham for 18 months on a lot of projects which didn't see the light of day, or a few did.
Was one of them the Odd Job film?
No, I didn't work on that.
Which never came out here.
No, well, it was...
cute idea.
Yeah, it was a very nice idea, but it was one of those things which had been worked on and reworked and reworked. Yeah. And by the time they'd actually got a final version of it, all the life had gone out of it. And the original script they had was much, much better than the eventual film. It was actually rather sort of small... in a curious kind of way, because I think so many changes have been made in response to so many people's suggestions, and they eventually began to work against each other, and the film rather shrank. But anyway, Python is those six guys. I mean,
right.
Python is those six guys, like the Beatles were those four guys.
Right, it's funny you mention that, because I refer to Python as the Beatles of comedy.
Yeah, that's I would go along with that very much. So, no, I didn't write for Python, as I'm constantly... And you try and tell people that, though. It drove me crazy, you know, because once an idea gets about, particularly if it's an inaccurate idea, well, it'll always...
There it is
it'll
in
always
print,
stay
I mean,
there.
You know.
Whereas in... If it's an accurate idea, it'll always get distorted.
Will you cross that out on my copy of the book?
There's some wonderful sort of magic about inaccurate ideas, which sort of preserve themselves. So it would get to the stage where I'd start doing interviews, and I was getting so upset about this particular thing. I would say, "Look, can I just before we start say I just want to make it clear I didn't work for Python." And say, "Hey, what Monty Python?" I say, "Yes, I didn't write for it." I say, "Hey, what was that like?" I said, "I don't know. I didn't do it." You know. No, and I know them all, some not very well. So I know Graham pretty well. I know Terry Jones is actually one of my best friends. And we constantly talk about doing things together, but it's usually just dinner. partly because I think there's a certain understandable reticence, I think, about introducing a professional job into... what starts off as a as a personal friendship, you know, because things can go wrong.
I'm flipping into the book here because I wanted to ask you about characters, getting back to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, all of the people through that. And you very evidently had occasionally some people in mind when you wrote the characters. There was one, and I was going to look this up before we did the interview. Is there really a woman in
all right, I'll tell you
Kensington
the story,
or wherever it no, is that's it the is. Worst poet in the...
what happened here was when I was writing, this is in the very first Hitchhiker script, and I'd done this thing about Bogon poetry, and I decided quite whimsically that Bogon poetry was going to be the third worst in the universe, therefore I had to top it in some way or other. So I said, okay, the second, and did a little sort of funny description of that and the Asgoths of Kriya. And then I was really stuck. How do I top that? I mean, what is going to be the worst poetry in the universe? And it was getting close to the stage where I had to get at least the first draft of this script delivered to the producer so we could... So I did what I occasionally do, which is sort of flag things in the script. I will put in... If I get stuck on an idea somewhere, I will put in something silly or something just to indicate to myself what my idea was, but that it's something I've got to go back to and get right. And so I just put in the name. Actually, it wasn't that name, but it was a name. The actual name was Paul Neil Milne Johnstone, of a guy who had been a roommate of mine at school, at high school. And he used to keep me up every night because he'd be sitting scribbling poetry. And it'd be all sorts of terrible stuff, like sort of dead swans lying in stagnant pools and this kind of stuff. And and he and I had never really sort of got on together at all. Well, we used to sort of fight and argue the whole time. And
that's enough to put you off on someone.
Right, yeah. And so just for the hell of it, I put in this sort of flag to myself in the script. The worst poetry of all died along with its creator, Paul Neil Milne Johnstone of Redbridge, Essex, England. That is utterly specific. An illustration of the planet Earth. And I left it and I was going. And when the producer, when I was having the meeting with the producer, I sort of mentioned that bit and said, that was just, you know, my own personal joke. I'm going to come up with something better there. And he said, no, I think it's funny, you know, because you've done these sort of wild, fantastical things. And then to be so ludicrously specific about something, even though obviously nobody knows the name, it obviously is very, very specific. Mm-hmm. And, that gives a very nice shape to that speech. And if I were you, I'd keep that in. So I thought, yeah, maybe that works. Maybe that's okay. And so the show started going out, and I know that Paul knew of it or had heard of it and so on. But he wasn't, you know, he was treating it with contempt.
Are there any other real names in it?
I'll just finish the story. And then the show went out again, and then it went out again, and then the record album came, and then the book came out and started selling in rather large quantities. And I think there was a little sort of chink, this little clinky chinks sort of suddenly went on in Paul's ears. And he started getting a little litigious. And sent a long letter to Pan Books explaining that it said, though I am not actually a poet as such or anymore, I am nevertheless completely involved in the sort of, I organised this poetry festival, ran that poetry magazine, blah, blah, blah. Went on for about two pages of this. Then saying, therefore, I reckon this is defamatory or derogatory to me, blah, blah, blah. But the letter ended up in the wrong department of Pan for a while because somebody read the first page or two and assumed this is a resume, you know, it was applying for a job. And then later, when it became evident that he was actually sort of seriously wanting to get the law on us in some way or other, I had to change, so we just changed the name, and I changed it from Paul Neil Milne Johnstone of Redbridge, Essex, to Paul and Nancy Millstone Jennings, which, whilst actually sort of slightly more insulting to him, was now sort of completely unactionable.
But it's, I think he missed his call. I think he probably should have released a book of poetry.
Well, that's what I thought.
The worst poetry in the universe.
If he had the slightest sort of sense of humour, which unfortunately dear Paul was not blessed with, he would have gone straight round to a publisher and say, hey, it's me, the worst poet in the universe. Here are some poems. You want to publish them? Yeah. That's what I would have done.
I can't help noticing you actually do wear a digital watch. much. It's not completely digital.
No, it isn't. Well, for a long time, I didn't at all. Now, this actually is a diving watch, and the reason I wear a diving watch is actually quite genuinely because I go scuba diving, and not just because it looks good. I got this at a time because I actually genuinely dislike the idea of just digital watches. I think they're
at least the ones you needed an extra hand to use.
That's right. I mean, it seemed to be completely self-defeating as a gimmick. If we'd originally had digital watches and then somebody had invented the analog watch, that would really been a great step forward. No, and I only got this because I was learning scuba diving over here, and then I was going to Australia to do some more, and I was traveling all around the place, and it became a big nuisance to me that I kept on having to change the local time, right, but stay in touch with England. And I would have to work out where I was and what the time difference was, so I wasn't going to wake people up in England. So actually having the extra little digital readout at the bottom, I just keep
he's
on...
squirming. He's really squirming.
quite right.
Douglas Adams, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.